battle scene. And so what I was thinking is we'll go through this section because it has a natural beginning and end to the section. Have some discussion, whatever discussion you'd like, and then we'll go on to the next section and we'll just go as far as time permits. Because what's listed for the next section or tomorrow morning is a lot. We won't cover it all tomorrow morning unless we do something tonight. So let's see how it goes. As you see the heading here, fight, flight, focus. So it starts with a fight, and then it gets into this, in the midst of a fight, something mystical display that leaves Dhruva a little paralyzed. And then he gets focused. So it's, besides the battle scene, there are things that are helpful for us to understand how to deal with shocking, surprising, confrontational type of situations, and what are the resources we can draw upon. The section deals a lot with the yakshas. So does anybody here, if you had to describe in, you know, two or three words, when you think of the yakshas, what does it mean to you? What comes to your mind? The yakshas. Who are they? Who are the yakshas? Raise your hand so I can call on you. Yes? I can't hear you. I can't hear you.
They're like demons.
They're like demons. Yes?
They fly in the sky.
They do what?
Fly.
They fly in the sky. Yes? Yeah, they have mystic powers. Yes? What do they do? Mystic powers. Yes. They're mystical creatures. Yes. They're followers and close associates of Kuvera. Now, what's their capital city? Where do they hang out? Alakapuri. Very good. Alakapuri is, according to this section that we're going to be reading, it's in the Himalayas, and it's the same place that Kuvera has as his headquarters, at least on Earth. And it's in Alakapuri where Ravana went to do battle with his half-brother or step-brother, Kuvera, and ransacked his kingdom and took his Pushpaka Vimana and took his pleasure city of Lanka that was actually built for him. And their father suggested, you better just give him the city. Alakapuri. They're really good fighters. They're in between higher beings and earthly beings. They're kind of like super beings of some kind. In Canto 3, Chapter 10, they're counted in a group. There's six groups of demigods. And they and the Rakshasas, they're direct sons of Brahma. That's how the lineage starts. And they're grouped in the demigod category, but they're kind of like semi-demigods. They're not controllers of the universe. And I'm going to read a little section just because it tells us something about who these personalities are, who Dhruva is going to be encountering. Way back in the beginning of creation, after Brahma has done this structuring of the universe, he's populating. Brahma threw off the body of ignorance, and taking this opportunity, yakshas and rakshasas sprang for possession of this body of ignorance, which continued to exist in the form of night. Overpowered by hunger and thirst, they ran to devour Brahma from all sides and cried, "Spare him not! Eat him up!" Whew. That's his sons. Text 21. This is chapter 20. Brahma, the head of the demigods, full of anxiety, asked them, "Do not eat me, but protect me. You are born from me and have become my sons. Therefore, you are yakshas and rakshasas." Purport. The demons who were born from the body of Brahma were called yakshas and rakshasas because some of them cried that Brahma should be eaten, and others cried that he should not be protected. The ones who said that he should be eaten were called yakshas. And the ones who said that he should not be protected became rakshasas, man-eaters. The two, yakshas and rakshasas, are the original creation of Brahma, and they are represented even until today in the uncivilized men who are scattered all over the universe. They are born of the mode of ignorance, and therefore, because of their behavior, they are called rakshasas or man-eaters. According to the glossary of the entire Veda base, they're born from the feet of Brahma. So where we ended up from the last session, Lord Vishnu has given his instructions to Dhruva, what he wants him to do, considered to be blessings, although it's not exactly what Dhruva considered to be blessings after he realized the good fortune of getting Lord Vishnu's mercy. He contemplated, and then he started returning home, and there was a grand reception, and everyone was very happy with him without exception, and he stayed in the palace under his father's protection, and he gradually matured, and his father at the proper time, considering his maturity and this acceptance of the citizens and the acceptance by the ministers, he installed him as king, and off he went to the forest to follow in the footsteps of his little son, Dhruva. And that's how the section closed. So now he's ruling, and we heard 36,000 years. Is that the number? 36? Huh? 36,000 years. Whew. There's some information about his lineage. He had two queens. Here's Dhruva. And one of the queens was named Brahmi. And two sons from Brahmi, Kalpa and Vatsara. And the second queen, Ila, had one son, one daughter, Utkala. Interesting names. Then in the summary of the first few verses, Dhruva Maharaja's younger brother, Uttama, who was still unmarried, once went on a hunting excursion and was killed by a powerful yaksha in the Himalaya mountains. Along with him, his mother, Saruchi, also followed the path of her son. She died. She died in a fire that we were told that Narada said that was going to happen, and that's what happened. So now he's got word that his brother, stepbrother, has been killed, and he's angry. Now, is anger appropriate for a kshatriya? It's absolutely required. Prabhupada speaks again and again and again and again in Bhagavad Gita classes about there's a class of, not the brahmanas are not to do, but the kshatriyas must do. When called upon, when it's required, Ramayana has it again and again as well. The Ikshvaku told his descendants that the one of the duties of a king in protecting is there are laws of dharma, and one who follows the laws of dharma is to be protected, and one who violates the laws of dharma is to be punished or checked. You know, Pritranaya Sadhanam Vinashayacha Duskritam. The king is the representative of God. The righteous king is the representative of God. He's to act that way and to be seen that way. So as God does, the representative of God does, according to the codes of God, according to the codes of Manu. The Manu is the giver of law, and Dhruva is his grandson. He knows the law, and so when there's a murder like this, then it's to be punished according to law. And so he's in this fight mode. But he's also, you know, getting a little slip up here, this revenge thing. Although he's a pure devotee, and he already went on the other side of all that stuff, here it is again. So how are we to regard that? I'm anticipating the question, so I'm answering it before people even ask it. Api chet sudhara charo bhajate mam ananya bhak sadureva samantavya. So Krishna says, when that situation is there, that like Dhruva, he's engaged in undivided devotional service for 36,000 years, when there's this bad behavior triggered by, who can say, then we're still to regard him as sadhu. Because Krishna regards him as sadhu, so we are to regard him that way. When Dhruva heard of the killing of his brother, Uttama, by the yakshas, now it's not the yakshas, it's one yaksha, in the Himalaya mountains, being overwhelmed with lamentation and anger, uh-oh, he's covered by Maya. He got on his chariot. Now, punishment by a king does not require lamentation and anger. I mean, violate, just like when Maharaj Parikshit saw or heard the someone dressed like a king was breaking the legs of a bull, in my kingdom, forget it. Get my army. So, Kshatriya anger is not like ours. So, anyway. He got on his chariot and went out for victory over the city of the Yakshas, Alakapuri. And when he got there, Dhruva, in the northerly direction of the Himalaya range, in a valley, he saw a city full of ghostly persons who were followers of Lord Shiva. They were followers of Kuvera, who is a follower of Lord Shiva. But they were worshippers of Lord Shiva, as followers of Kuvera. So that's a nice painting. There's the valley, and there's these strange-looking people, the Yakshas, that were inhabiting the city. And he did what fighters at the time would do, blew upon his giant conch shell there. My dear Vidura, as soon as Dhruva Maharaj reached Alakapuri, he immediately blew his conch shell and the sound reverberated throughout the entire sky and in every direction. The wives of the Yakshas became very much frightened. From their eyes it was apparent that they were full of anxiety. So a battle's going to begin. That's why it's going to be a short session, because this and that and back and forth. Oh, hero Vidura, the greatly powerful heroes of the Yakshas, unable to tolerate the resounding vibration of the conch shell of Dhruva Maharaj, came forth from their city with weapons and attacked Dhruva. Dhruva Maharaj, who was a great charioteer and certainly a great bowman, also immediately began to kill them by simultaneously discharging arrows three at a time. So the battle scene just summarized. Even though attacked severely by Dhruva, the Yakshas still applauded Dhruva. They thought, wow, this is a good match. The Yaksha soldiers were 130,000 strong, all greatly angry and all desiring to defeat the wonderful activities of Dhruva Maharaj. They covered Dhruva Maharaj with showers of arrows. Dhruva looked like a mountain covered by incessant rainfall. No worries, though. When a mountain is covered by incessant rain, all dirty things are washed from the body of the mountain. Similarly, the incessant shower of arrows from the enemy gave Dhruva Maharaj new vigor to defeat them. In other words, whatever incompetency he might have had was washed away. Okay, so now in this image you see the Siddhas and the Charanas and the celestial beings watching the scene from their Vimanas up there in the sky. And down below is a big battle that's being waged. I can't read it. Cries of dismay arose from the Siddhas watching in the sky. He has been killed. The grandson of Manu. Like the sun has sunk in the ocean of yakshas. But the sun doesn't sink in the ocean. Although seeming to drown in the ocean, the sun is not harmed. Similarly, Dhruva had no difficulty. And Vishwanath says it very nicely. Like the sun in the ocean, he has disappeared in the ocean of yakshas. The hidden meaning is that even in this condition, Dhruva could not be harmed. Just as the sun is not harmed by setting in the ocean, the yakshas, being temporarily victorious, exclaimed that they had conquered Dhruva Maharaj. But in the meantime, Dhruva's chariot suddenly appeared, just as the sun suddenly appears from within foggy mist. Battle scenes. It goes back and forth. Dhruva Maharaj's bow and arrows twanged and hissed, causing lamentation in the hearts of his enemies. He began to shoot incessant arrows, shattering all their different weapons, just as the blasting wind scatters the assembled clouds in the sky. That's two verses in one. This is simply summary because it's battle. So here's some of the descriptions of the battle. Dhruva's arrows dismantled the bodies of the yakshas, just like Indra's thunderbolt would dismantle mountains. Yakshas flee from the battlefield just like herds of elephants who had become the plaything of a lion. Interesting image, huh? Speaking to his charioteer, cautious and worrying about a counterattack by the enemy, because they kind of like receded, just like silence. Dhruva then heard a sound which seemed to come from the ocean. He then saw dust in all directions caused by the wind. And then he saw all these things you see in the painting. Clouds rained, torrents of blood, mucus, pus, stool, urine, and marrow. Human trunks began to fall from the sky. Maces, swords, iron-spiked clubs, and other clubs began to fall. Snakes, breathing thunderbolts and vomiting fire, along with herds of mad elephants, lions, and tigers. It's their mystical display. And he's struck in awe. Oceans became fierce as if it was the end of a culprit. Now, they're in the Himalaya Mountains. There's no oceans in the Himalaya Mountains. But oceans were coming. So now comes the fight or flight. He's bewildered by the whole situation. That's exactly what they wanted. Dhruva is bewildered by the yakshas' illusions. Mystical mountains. That's in the upper right corner. Animals all around. Oceans. Thunder, lightning, various threatening visions. Fortunately, he had some ministers with him. They were very calm. The sages said, "Oh, Dhruva, may the Supreme Lord, carrier of the bow, reliever of distress of the surrendered souls, by hearing or chanting whose name, people easily cross unsurpassable death, kill your enemies." The sages thought if one can cross death by hearing about the Lord, then Dhruva could easily overcome the Yaksha's magic spell. Thus, they made him remember the Narayana weapon. Now, it doesn't say how he got the Narayana weapon, but he had one. Narayana Astra. So Dhruva prepares to fire the Narayana Astra. As soon as Dhruva Maharaj joined the Narayana Astra arrow to his bow, the illusion created by the Yakshas was immediately vanquished. Just as all material pains and pleasures are vanquished when one becomes fully cognizant of the self. So, I just share this with you. From time to time, there's going to be a little subjective question about what do you do? Are there times when you feel, what do I do? The fight or flight. So anyway, when just by a little tap on the shoulder by the sages, Dhruva, remember who you are. Don't get caught in illusion. You're a spirit soul. You're very dear to Vishnu. You're a liberated soul. Remember, Dhruva. Just take that Narayana. So just as soon as you, oh yeah, I'm Krishna's servant and I meant to, whatever the situation is, be in his service. As soon as that gesture, that consciousness is established, the whole situation looks different. Whatever it is, whatever it appears to be. That's my experience. So Narayana Astra, that's a nice image from the internet. Without Narayana, this is Prabhupada's purport, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, no one can overcome the action of the illusory energy. So a common advice for all of us, what's our astra? You got it. Sangopangasta parshadam. That's that word astra. The association sangha, upanga, and astra. Sangha, the association of devotees. Upanga, his associates. And astra, the holy name. In this age, the Narayana Astra, or weapon to drive away Maya, is the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra. Prabhupada's purport. Krishna is like the sun, and Maya, or the illusory energy of Krishna, is like darkness. Darkness means absence of light. Similarly, Maya means absence of Krishna consciousness. Krishna consciousness and Maya are always there side by side. As soon as there is awakening of Krishna consciousness, all the illusory pains and pleasures of material existence are vanquished. Now, it doesn't mean you don't stub your toe and it doesn't hurt. But the absorption in that temporary situation is withdrawn. The absorption in the temporary situation is withdrawn. Tell a little Prabhupada story. I heard this from Hari. I had Prabhupada's stories, from Hari's story about bodily pain. One time Prabhupada had an abscess tooth, means an infected tooth, and his whole jaw was swollen. You know how painful you have a tooth infection. So they were asking Prabhupada if he wanted to go to a dentist to have something done. He said, just give me some cloves. So he put some cloves in his mouth and put it next to the swollen abscess and just carried on like it wasn't even there. So it's, it has some nerve pain-killing effect and just went on. And then some days later, he was taking prasadam. He reached in his mouth, pulled out the tooth, handed it to Hari Sori, said, here, you can keep this, and went on with his meal. And it wasn't a Dhruva Maharaj Satyayuga story either. Then, because I found this out just by asking, because I knew that Hari Sori had a liver problem. So I was asking him, how's your liver problem healing? And, he said a couple of things. I don't remember what that was. And he just went to Prabhupada from his association. And then, so another, he was continuing, we're having lunch together, said, Prabhupada had problem with his kidneys. And it wasn't a well-known fact. I didn't know it at all. But that travel back, he was planning to go to the West, but he stopped in London because there was a kidney failure. And what do kidneys do? They take toxins from the body and eliminate them through the urine. That's what, as far as I understand, what kidneys do. And one of them wasn't working, the other was half working, which means his body was filled with toxins, which means his body was always in pain. But I didn't know that. And those that were his associates, apparently, they had some idea. So he said, but Prabhupada never, he said only twice did he stop because the pain. And he told one story. He said one night, it was like 1 o'clock in the morning, Prabhupada rang the bell because there was a buzzer system to call the servant. And it was, Prabhupada had a chadar over his head and wrapped around his body. And it wasn't really cold. He was just like shivering in pain and didn't even look at Hari Sori. He just said, it's too much pain. I can't work. That his body was always in pain. He just transcended the pain. One other story. Something that I personally saw. This was during the Krishna Balaram deity installation in Vrindavan. It was like a big shindig, big celebration, big festival. 3 days. The governor of UP came on the third day with all of their, entourage. The whole big thing. Police, they were there for 3 days ahead of time just, for security. And anyway, without all those details. And the Goswamis of Vrindavan, they were doing the yajna, so all their followers. And it was a whole, amazing scene. And while all of that was going on in the temple room, Srila Prabhupada, during the afternoon, was conducting just darshan. And one of those days, just the day before the deity installation, the final third day of the installation, the darshan time was over, Prabhupada got up from behind his desk, little sitting place, you've seen, probably those of you that have been to Vrindavan. And as he was walking, to his right side, there's a fireplace, black marble fireplace, and somebody spilled water. and they didn't clean up the spill of the water. So his foot slipped, and he went crashing onto the fireplace, the whatever you call that front part of the fireplace. And he twisted his ankle. And, you know, he displayed several things. I wasn't there, but I heard from those that were there. He displayed strong chastisement of the person that spilled water and left the water. Whenever I spill something, I think of this. You gotta clean it up. Who knows? What, you know, I'm busy. So what? You clean up. That's part of your being busy. So, because someone could slip. Even if you're gonna go somewhere else, someone else could. So you make a mess and you clean up the mess. Immediately. And then he requested some herbs, some leaves, and some string. And he made a poultice with the herbs, put the leaves around the swelling of his ankle, and tied it together with string. Dr. Prabhupada. He knew exactly what to do. And so I remember the next day after the deity installation, so he's on the altar doing the deity installation, then he went and sat down and gave class. And because his foot was swollen, it was sticking out a little bit from the Vyasa Sun, and it was like really close to the Vyasa Sun, and I could see this thread and string and the leaves on three sides of his ankle and the Ayurvedic herbs packed underneath the leaves to keep the swelling from getting too much. So he did what was practical. He instructed so that not just the person that spilled the water, so that everyone could understand, you don't spill water and leave the water. You make a mistake, you correct the mistake. So anyway, I forget why I told the story. Huh? Yeah, transcending pain, thanks. So, pains and pleasures of material existence are vanquished by higher consciousness. That is, Prabhupada he was aware of the pain, that the pain of his tooth and the pain of his ankle and the pain of his kidneys, he was aware. He just transcended it. He just transcended it. No, we're not Prabhupada, and you know, we feel pain and we do other things besides transcend it, but that's what higher consciousness can do. Not just, you know, physical pain, the other kind, the mental, emotional. So if we can become trained and help support others in the going to higher consciousness, towards Krishna consciousness position, it can help ourselves and others deal with the misfortune of material existence. The adiatmika, adidaivika, adibhautika kleshas of material existence. Okay, so now we're going back to, there's a little bit of sound connected with this. Let's see if it works. Hang on a minute. That's the sound of his arrows. Even as Dhruva Maharaj fixed. Oh. the sound isn't coming also. Anyway. Even as Dhruva Maharaj fixed the weapon made by Narayana Rishi, that's where the Narayana Astra came from, onto his bow, arrows with golden shafts and feathers like the wings of a swan flew out from it. Looks like a peacock, not a swan, but anyway. Huh? Okay. They entered the enemy soldiers with a great hissing sound, just as, there we go, peacocks enter a forest with tumultuous crowing. Anyone that's visited Giranagari knows what that sound is. They do have a peacock concert. They get together and dance a little bit and make their peacock sound, and then 10 of them do their peacock sound. They listen for the next one, and it's a really loud sound too. Okay, so back to the battle. Attacked by the yakshas, Dhruva cut off their arms, thighs, necks, and torsos with his arrows and brought them to Satyaloka, where the brahmacharis go after surpassing the sun. Now, this is a detail of Vedic culture. It's in the verse and it's described by Vishwanath this way. Getting killed by the Lord and his devotees only brings benefit, but it's not the benefit of liberation, because being killed by the hand of a devotee, they got special elevation but not liberation. This is Vishwanath. As the Gita says, they return again to earth. Abrahma Bhuvanal Loka Purnar Avarta Norjana. From all planets up to Brahmaloka, people return. O Arjuna, one should not think that they attain liberation with the sannyasis at the end of Brahma's day. That is because one does not even see liberation given to others killed by the Lord, such as Kalanemi, other than when killed by Krishna. Now this is, it's a big deal. I say big deal. It's spoken of in several places in the Sandarbhas by Jiva Goswami. It's being spoken here specifically by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. That is, being killed by Dhruva, or being killed by a devotee, or being killed even by Vishnu, such as Kalanemi was killed by Vishnu, but he didn't get liberation. Only when killed by Krishna, that was Kamsa, because previously Kamsa was Kalanemi, right? He got liberation. So Krishna alone, amongst even the Vishnu tattva features. So we'll just do a little, have a little fun. Here's a 18th century painting of, over on our right side, that's Lord Vishnu. It's actually Ajita, specifically. He kills Kalanemi. And the circumstance of Vishnu killing Kalanemi, and he doesn't get liberation, is connected with the churning of the ocean of milk. And this question came up, I don't mind repeating. It's not the milk ocean, it's Swayta Dweep. It's one of the oceans surrounding the circular islands, that ocean of milk. It's specific by our acharyas saying that. So after the churning, many things were produced. One of the things that was produced was the Amrita, and by cleverness, Mohini Murti asked the demons for the Amrita, and she gave it to the demigods. And one of the demons figured it out, and that was Rahu, and she cut off his head. So then Rahu was, his head is floating around somewhere out there, one of the planets. So the demons were like frustrated. So they weren't getting what they wanted, so they started a battle. So this is Canto 8, Chapter 10, describing the battle. It's a long battle chapter. And in the course of the battle, the demigods had defeated the demons. The demons came back strong, headed by Bali Maharaj, and they were becoming victorious. The demigods then took shelter of Ajita, or Vishnu. And then here's the verse. When the demon Kalanemi, who was carried by a lion, saw that the Supreme Personality of Godhead, carried by Garuda, was on the battlefield, the demon immediately took his trident, whirled it, and discharged it at Garuda's head. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Hari, the master of the three worlds, immediately caught the trident, and with the very same weapon he killed the enemy, Kalanemi, along with his carrier, the lion. Then some additional verses said, so many other demons were killed, Shukracharya came along and brought them back to life again, and Krishna and Vishnu killed them again. But so the reference is that this Kalanemi and the others didn't get liberation. Only when killed by Krishna does one get that kind of liberation, even Putana and other bad people. Now, just for fun, there's two other examples of Kalanemi. And one of them we're more familiar with, and that has to do with who was Kamsa in his previous life? Kalanemi. So the Kalanemi that Kamsa was in his previous life is connected with Hiranyakashipu. It goes like this. Hiranyakashipu had, of course, a son. That's Prahlad, who was pushing off his lap. But he had a grandson. Not Prahlad's son, but some other grandson. And his name was Kalanemi. And that grandson of Hiranyakashipu had six sons. And those six sons, they did the same thing that Hiranyakashipu did. They went into the forest to get eternality, and Brahma came and said, you know, you want what you want, immortality? No, you have to ask for something else. So they asked for similar things, and that seeking immortality. Don't be killed by this, that, and the other thing. And Hiranyakashipu came to know. So he went and cursed them. That the sons of Kalanemi, you will be killed by your father in your next life. So Kalanemi was killed by Vishnu, but Kalanemi didn't get liberation. He became Kamsa. Now Kamsa wasn't one of the Jai Vijay duets, Shishupal and Dantavakra. So Kamsa was Kalanemi, whose six sons were then killed. The sons of Vasudeva and Devaki were killed by the previous lifetime's father. So that's how we know that Kalanemi. It's different than the Kalanemi number one already mentioned. And not only that, there's Kalanemi number three. That's a good name for a demon, I guess. And he's found in Ramayana. I couldn't find a good painting, so we took this one. This is Maricha, after he had been put in terrible fear by Lord Ramachandra. He became an ascetic, so Ravana came to Maricha requesting very humbly that either you do what I want or I'll kill you, you track Sita so I can kidnap Sita, assume the form of a deer, etc. So that Maricha is in Ramayana, and Kalanemi, number three, was the son of Maricha. Maricha himself was the son, this is a long story in Ramayana, son of Sunda, and his mother was Tataka. So Tataka is that first demon that Vishvamitra Muni wanted Ram and Lakshman to help slay. And so Tataka was slain, that's the mother, and Maricha was thrown hundreds of miles into the sea by another arrow, and then in this Aranyakanda, he tells Ravan that it happened again, another time he gives the details, so he's like, I don't want to mess with Ram. So you can go mess with Ram, but don't count me in. And Ravan says, well, you do it or I'll kill you. He said, well, I'd rather be killed by Ram than by you. So, Kalanemi was Maricha's son, and he served as a minister in Lanka, minister to Ravan, and minister that had a fighting capacity also. Go ahead, do it quickly. The slow motion pujari. But that's okay. So, and when Hanuman, when the Vanaras came, he was assigned to kill Hanuman, and guess who won? And he didn't get liberation. So all of that is just to underscore what Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur is saying, that when Dhruva killed the Yakshas, they didn't get liberation, but they got, by his mercy, a special arrangement, like brahmacharis that are strict in brahmachari life, and Yakshas aren't known to be strict brahmacharis, they got the same destination. When passing, going beyond the path of the sun, they achieve brahmaloka, beyond heaven, but not liberation. Okay, so back to the story. Swayambhuva Manu saw the whole scene. That's the grandfather, Uttanapada's father, Swayambhuva Manu. So when Swayambhuva Manu saw that his grandson Dhruva was killing so many of the Yakshas, were not actually offenders, that is to say, one, but not everybody, you know, do this. So out of his great compassion for his son, his grandson, he approached Dhruva with great sages to give him good instruction. So this next slide is our last slide before Swayambhuva Manu starts his instruction. It's a reflection request. Has it ever happened that when there's some sudden confrontational situation that appears before you, you're startled and this fight or flight response just kind of kicks in and takes over? And if that happens ever, then how do you bring your attention and your focus back to being in the mood of service? Well, instructions. You have a close friend and well-wisher, or a grandfather of the caliber of Swayambhuva Manu, you're in good shape. And otherwise, you can remember this little scene. and we can hear the instructions of Swayambhuva Manu and try to remember from the potency of Srimad Bhagavatam's message to carry us on the other side of fight or flight. This is similar to the react or respond topic that we discussed before. So that's the last slide for this particular section of verses. Let's turn the light on and see if anybody would like to discuss anything that we covered. And if not, we'll just move on to the next set of slides. Yes. Do we have a portable microphone? Put your hand up again, please.
Guru Maharaj, when we follow along personalities like Dhruva Maharaj and feeling inspired, situations like this, to me, make them feel inaccessible for a moment.
They don't see what?
Situations described in this section of Srimad Bhagavatam, where Dhruva Maharaj is again losing himself to anger. To me, those moments makes me feel, or those characters to me make, they seem inaccessible. So I understand the Abhijit Sudracharo verse that they are still situated in devotional service.
It happens.
To me the question is, where is that coming from? Why? Because even Swayambhuva Manu didn't approve of his anger is coming out of a Kshatriya anger.
Well, so there's two main sources, possible sources. One is Super Soul is inspiring it so that we can hear Manu's and then following that Kuvera's instructions and see how we can respond when we just get a tap on the shoulder and somebody gives us a reminder. That's one possible source where it's coming from. And another can be the tsunami example. You know, there's some disturbance out there in the, what do they call it, tectonic plates. And some that shift in the earth, and then that shift makes a sound, and that sound makes a wave of, and it just covers the ocean. You know, the ocean wave comes in and covers the land. So just some quirk of the material nature just becomes overwhelming. Can be either one. Because otherwise, the tsunami example, it's the tide comes in, the tide goes out, the tide. So we deal with situations of life and it's just fine. And then sometimes by arrangement of nature, there's this extraordinary situation that just becomes overwhelming. That's where it's coming from. It's just the quirks of nature. Now, what's behind the quirks of nature, Super Soul? So it can be something from within or something from without that's controlled by Super Soul. That's where it's coming from. And so what does the devotee do? Bhajate mam ananya bhak. As soon as the situation recedes a little bit by this or that, it's bhajate mam ananya bhak. It literally circumstantial. It's not characteristic. So where does the circumstance come from? Either one of those two sources primarily. There may be others, but that's primarily. Yes.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. Thank you so much for explaining us so nicely in a step by step. From the previous slides, I came to understand a few things, and then I want to clear myself whether my understanding is clear.
Okay.
So, in Dhruva Maharaj, when he returns back, so his pair, the Surichi, before she was so angry, and then now she suddenly, she
nice.
Is so caring, and So I was thinking that usually in material world, if somebody success and then they come back, so there is an envy for that person.
Yeah.
But in the spiritual, if Krishna is in the center, so there is no envy. So that's what I was thinking. So is my understanding is correct?
Well, specifically with Suruchi, that's the one you're speaking about, right?
And then his brother, cousin.
Okay. He wasn't inimical. His stepbrother, Uttam, we don't hear much about, you know, it's his mom. She was, in the nasty space. Doesn't say anything about him, one way or the other way. He could have been, in the same mood as her, but he doesn't say. We don't assume anything with him, because it doesn't say. But specifically with her, the explanation that Prabhupada gave, there may be more to it, she may have also felt terrible. She maybe didn't. Good, he's out of the way. She could have felt that too. But because Dhruva had become so spiritually elevated in his presence, that nastiness went away. Mm-hmm. And instead, she felt motherly affection in his place. By his influence, by his spiritual influence. Mm. Okay?
Yes. And one more, my understanding is, when we see that in devotional in path, like some obstacle come, and then we say that it's all our karma, all maya. Maya is so strong. But thank you for making us understand one more thing, that even Krishna sends a pure devotee to make us more determined towards Krishna. So like he sent Narad Muni for Dhruva Maharaj. Like usually we think like, oh, when some obstacle come, we say, oh, it's all my karma. Oh, his maya is so strong. But here we see that Krishna is sending a pure devotee to help Dhruva to make his determination more stronger. So that's what I thought in my understanding. So
it's not exactly to make his determination stronger. It's to elevate that determination to a higher place, while at the same time addressing his lower expectation. We were using this word expectation. Mm-hmm. This lower expectation, I want the kingdom expectation, passion, avaricious, greedy, artarti, so that was being recognized. His honor had been pinched, and he had become enraged by that, by her heart. So he was recognizing all those things. So he was giving him a means to fulfill what he wanted, and to rise above what he wanted. To, the material side of what he wanted. Because our acharyas say he had two wants. He actually wanted to become a devotee. And he also wanted to get back. Mm. And get his material thing. But, so Krishna or Super Soul sent his pure devotee not just, to fulfill what he wants, but to connect him with Vishnu, because that's what that desire was there, and the means to achieve that was awakened. So for every one of us, it's like Madhupati was asking, is Madhupati here this evening? No. He was asking, why is it that Dhruva, what was special about Dhruva that he became so determined? Was it previous lifetimes of unknown sukriti, unknown activity? We don't know. It doesn't say. Maybe. We don't know. But for one thing is, he had faith in his mother, and what his mother said, he took to heart, and that connected his determination to what his mother said. I'm going to achieve Vishnu. So his determination was arising from his passion, I want, but the bhakti part came from his mother. Now there may have been other persons who he had heard from in the course of living in the palace, because there were other devotee personalities in the audience, in the palace. But for sure his mother.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. Maharaj, this is regarding the Narayana Astra for devotees, Sangopasana. So, Maharaj, is the understanding correct that this Narayana Astra, as devotees, we should use to focus on the right things?
Yes.
Rather than use that Astra to solve the problem? Because then there is a problem of complacency, that we don't want to act, we will just say, oh, let me just use Narayana Astra and not do anything. Meaning just, chant or depend on Krishna.
Oh, there's other flaws in that the utility utilized for your purposes mentality. But that self-centeredness tendency is there in conditioned souls. Anyway, you can say no. But it's there anyways. So now what? Well, we're not impersonalists. Akama, sarvakama, vamokshika. So we engage, even if it's for some selfish purpose, with tivra bhakti. So we want to cultivate selfless service for the pleasure of the personality of Godhead. We want to cultivate that, but we're not there yet, fully. So we connect, we dovetail. I'm not like making an excuse for weakness, because what happens, yes, complacency sets in when I get what I want, and now I don't have that same need anymore because I got what I want. See you later, Krishna. I'm checking out. Oh, now here comes the need again. Oh, Krishna. So, that's our unsteadiness. Or one of the varieties of unsteadiness. Does that address your question? You want to say something further?
No, I was looking more, Maharaj, from the angle of if there are, issues coming in our life, then we need to act to it.
Yeah.
Rather than just say, oh, I will just depend on Krishna. So,
of course.
Yeah, so sometimes we may feel, oh, okay, now I don't want to act anything because, I will just chant. But I think chanting will help us to, and that is what I wanted to, check with you. Is that correct understanding?
Well, it's a correct understanding that we should take appropriate action. It is a correct understanding that we should take appropriate action, but we may not know what appropriate action is.
Yes.
And in such a case, chant.
Chant, yes. So.
And go to people that are more mature, more elevated, and more detached, because our attachments are part of what prevents us from seeing what is appropriate action. Our attachments will help prevent us from seeing what's appropriate action.
Yes.
Or take inappropriate action to be appropriate action and go for it. So pause is good. Mode of goodness is good.
Yes, much.
And in that mode of goodness space, seek clarity and then act with clarity.
Yes, yeah, that makes sense. Thank you.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. My question is, especially when we are still, we are still learning to be in the mood of service. So when sudden confrontational situation comes, we need to act at that situation, and to an extent, by nature, because not being so aggressive, so we try to tolerate for some time and try to explain what is good for them. But beyond that, like, I was not sure, like, how do we act in those situations when the opposing person is acting unreasonably, I would say.
I know the person you're speaking about. That one?
Generally also.
I think we should have an offline discussion about that one. Because, you know, your question is not naming the name of the person, but it's all around, all over the place, and it's a little abstract to give an answer, because it's too, you know, it's not specific. So what's appropriate for situation A may not be the same for B, C, and D. So customize the response for the situation, time, place, circumstance, and the person involved. So I'm really reluctant to give answers to those generic,
yes, Maharaj,
non-specific things.
So I struggle with a few Srimad Bhagavatam purports in terms of being different to the Guru Parampara, but also showing my intellectual dissent. And I really struggle with it, and I and Paramrupa Prabhu have been having a fight back and forth on three purports since last night. How do we deal with this? And most of the time I just get beaten up. Paramrupa Prabhu is nice in giving me a back and forth. How do I deal with it?
I know how you deal with it. But that's, so it's, how might I deal with it? That's another question. And, you know, how you deal with it, you just keep going at it. How I deal with it is, I had a situation like you're describing with another devotee whose name I won't mention, you know, within the past month. And I just smiled. And I said, you know, we disagree. You have this view and I have that view, and we don't have to, like, go over it and over it and over it and over it. We have a different point of view. But you have a different nature. That's what I would do.
I have an objective. My objective is that I want some of the purports to be modified by the BBT. And that's
okay,
my
goal. Then there's a procedure. But you know, who are you? You follow procedure. Your personality is your personality is your personality is your personality. So you're not going to change, but you know, it's not going to change the purport because you got your personality. There's a procedure, and they're following a procedure on certain purports, more than one. There's one outstanding one, and there's more than one. So I don't want to have you go back and forth with me on this right now, please. That's what you do. You just dismiss the other person. Okay. Until you?
I was trying to understand the position of mother of Dhruva Maharaj. Is there a description if she's considered to be a pure devotee or a mixed devotee?
There's no description like that. It's just her qualities match that of a pure devotee. That's my evaluation. It's not a statement that says she's a pure devotee.
Okay.
Her qualities match the qualities of a pure devotee.
So the question that I was trying to frame around this is that So as a parent or as a mother, I am at a very mixed platform, a very, you know, initial level of devotional service. Is there a way that a mixed person, a mixed devotee can become instrument of Guru and Krishna in a pure way?
Yeah, become a pure devotee. It's not a rhetorical answer. It's a literal answer. You want a shortcut?
No,
you have to go through the procedure. You have to go through the, you know, making yourself clean. To be clean. To become pure. And you strive for it. And you strive by right means and you'll get there. Krishna says. You're not satisfied with that.
And no, another context to that is like, my children are growing. And
of course.
There's a time, I mean, there's a lot of time before I, you know, even think of reaching that state. So it's my mixed devotion, you know, is, so.
It's being passed on to your children.
Yes.
Yeah. So you should have thought of that before you had children. Chuckle, chuckle, chuckle. Meanwhile, that's what's being passed on to the children is being passed on to the children. It's not just you. It's everybody that has children. And then, you know, that's everybody that's a teacher. I mean, from the questions, or not comment questions, the observations and comments made by Devaki Nandan, he recognizes his function in this community also as a counselor. I'm sure he's looked up to it. So ask him, are you a pure devotee, Devaki? So are you being able to guide people perfectly because of you're a pure devotee? And he's like, you know, but he's doing for his purification. And it's a very, very valuable service that he's doing. And your service as a Nick's devotee mother is a very valuable service because you're striving for pure devotion. As long as you're striving, then that's good. Keep going. And is it going to be less than perfect? Absolutely. But, you know, things are, I was chuckling as you were chuckling, and I thought you saw me chuckling about, I was chuckling about your daughters being really serious into being Dhruva. But I was also thinking, that's going to be with her for a long time. That impression of being really serious about becoming a pure devotee. I mean, in her own little way. But, so it's that's part of what those of us that are imperfect in trying to pass on to the children. It's part of teaching, it's part of parenting, it's part of being a, you know, a village elder, being a counselor, being a whatever we are. We're less than perfect. That's the acceptance and progress message. So if you want to sit there and hold the microphone for a longer time, that's okay. But you can go back and listen to those recordings of the acceptance and progress. Gita Nagari retreat. It's all there. Acceptance and progress. Not just progress and feel bad that you aren't pure. They accept. And progress in a realistic way, a doable, small steps at a time way. That's what you do. By the way, I don't think I commented. The response that you gave to your daughter about the neighbor and how she should deal with, you know, their stuff, I thought that was really cool. It was really, I mean, it's like, whether it's going to work or not. It was really nice advice. Yo, it's compliments for less than perfect mother. Nice going. Yes, back there.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. Can you explain me a little more about the Vasudeva state and what was missing in Dhruva's devotion about this Vasudeva state?
Well, what we read specifically, I spoke a little different message. So what we read specifically was, when the Lord appeared before Dhruva, he attained the Vasudeva state. And I said, like Krishna appeared in the mind of Vasudeva because he was in the Vasudeva state. Vasudeva state meaning Vishuddha Sattva. So Dhruva was in that state. Otherwise, when he was meditating upon the Supreme Lord, he was in trance. I mean, consider what was going on the physical plane, but on the platform of the mind, he was completely absorbed. We heard the Sanskrit. In his intelligence, in his soul, the Supreme Personality of Godhead had entered fully. That's the Vasudeva state. Vishuddha Sattva. And to further reciprocate with that Vishuddha position, the Vasudeva state position, Vishnu decided to show himself before Dhruva and speak with him and have him speak to him and enable him to speak nicely. That was a very personal gesture. In addition to, so your specific question was, explain more about the Vasudeva state. It's Vishuddha Sattva. And when it's clean, the Lord appears. If you want to understand it further, I suggest you read that section where Krishna appears in the mind of Vasudeva. It's explained very nicely what the Vasudeva state is. Read in Krishna book, read in the Bhagavatam, read the commentaries. It's a 10th canto passage. There's multiple commentaries by multiple acharyas on the 10th canto. So you'll get a really clear picture from that. Do your homework. And you'll find out what you want to find out. Is that okay?
Yeah. Thank you, Mata.
Yes. Over on this side, ladies.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, this is regarding fault finding. How to engage the mind away from fault finding? And sometimes it becomes difficult to stop fault finding with the spouse.
Okay. It's not uncommon. I would say the other. Not fault finding is uncommon. So how to avoid it? Or minimize it, at least. Well, instruction to refrain, that's one. Another is the mood of service. Bhakti takes care of that tendency, because we were discussing this. The faculty of intelligence is to discern or discriminate one thing from another thing. You know, this is a shoe and it goes on my foot, and over there is my sibling's ear and it doesn't go in my mouth. So children have to learn that their intelligence is to discern one thing from another thing. So, from Bhagavad Gita, we're given tools to discern modes of nature, for example. And then we can see as Krishna sees. Now, is Krishna fault-finding when he sees? He's just discerning, saying this is this and that's that and the other thing is the other thing. These are the modes of nature. There's how they operate. So we can see as Krishna sees. That's intelligence, discrimination. But then the error of, aha, I caught you, mode of ignorance. Mode of passion. Just look at you. So, that's you're judging and not in a mode of service is somewhere else. It's a mode of, I'm big and you're not big. You're small. And I'm judging you. So that's unwholesome. So that's the do not. Because the Bible teaching is, judge not lest ye be judged. Or Bhaktisiddhanta's words is, don't find fault in others, for by so doing you're showing that your own heart is honeycombed with the same fault. How embarrassing. And it's true. That is to say, someone that's heart isn't honeycombed with fault can discern, but they're not fault-finding. Where's the dirt? Where's the flaw? Where's the shortcoming? And you live with somebody and you can see in close, perspective. Where's the quality? Where's the fault? As they can see in you, where's the quality? Where's the fault? That's what happens when you get, it's one thing to be a friend. It's another thing to have a roommate. And it's another thing to be married. Being married isn't just being a roommate. It's a whole other thing. Some people think it's like having a roommate. It's not. So, service. Krishna is making an arrangement for me to be in this relationship where I, as spirit soul, am serving another spirit soul to get closer to Krishna. And I'm less than perfect, so I'm going to mess up because I'm less than perfect. It's just my nature. Please, I'm acknowledging that. I'm not bragging about it. And I want to progress. And, let me see what I can be of help to you to progress. Let me see what you can do to help me progress. That's our relationship, spouse. And it gets entangling and we have our spots where it's like, ouch. Anyway, marriage. I know somebody that doesn't want to get married for the wrong reason. I just don't want to go through that. That's aversion. Is the flip side of attachment. They're really attached, but they just don't want to. It's impersonal. So how do you be a person in a close relationship like marriage? You have to be accepting of the other person and be in the mood of service. And ideally, they'll also be accepting of you in the mood of service. And it's not always like that. And that's part of marriage until you're perfect. It's part of the relationship in marriage. But so specific to fault finding is the mood of service. And acceptance. And how can I be of service to help you go to whatever is the next doable step? And maybe it's just like, be really patient for a whole bunch of time. Have no expectation. Just be in that mood of service. And if you stay in that mood of service, perhaps, not like an expectation, but perhaps the other person is going to say, wow, they really want to be in the mood of service. Because sometimes there's evaluation and testing going on. You really want to be in mode of service, huh? Because 5 years ago you said something that wasn't service, and I still remember it. You know, those of you that are married. Then be in the mood of service. Continue to discern according to the teachings of Bhagavad Gita and our acharyas. And, you know, certain role models like Prahlad. Gosh. Father tried to kill him. And he just wanted well wishing for his father. And not only his father, all the fools and rascals that are chasing after illusion and getting suffering instead. Well wishing for them. I don't want to be liberated without their being going back also. Anyway, mood of service. Genuine Vaishnav character. Follow up to that one. Okay. Sure. We've already gone over time, by the way. I thought this was going to be a shorter class, and it turned out to be a longer one. Go ahead. No, it's okay.
So
last question.
About the mood of service, Maharaj.
Mood of service.
So how to inculcate that? Because many times what happens,
The chant awakens the mood of service. That's what it is. And associate with those that have the mood of service. That's how you awaken it.
Like, if you want to see practically, Maharaj, like what would be the suggestion? Because many times happens...
I'm sorry. I'm cutting you off. It's practical. Chanting is very practical. Association with those that have the mood of service. Gosh. So practical. No. You're right in the thick of things. There are devotees that aren't in the thick of things like you are. And one of them was expressing to me sadhu sangha. This during this time together. And without it, how are we going to maintain without sadhu sangha? It was specific to what Dhruva was asking for, but it was also their experience in, you know, this. And now we're coming together and we're all less than perfect beings. And we, you know, spend some time together and you'll find more about the less than perfectness of each of us. We're less than perfect beings.
Yes.
But there's bhakti. So it's practical. No, you want to say something further.
Yeah, maybe I used the wrong word, but I was looking some advice on what happened in many times in the situation. We may have a superior position, like parent, for example.
Mm.
So parent want to correct the kid. And that time, how we can have the mood of service. So that is what I wanted to know. Maharaj.
Parenting question.
Yes, Maharaj.
Well, it starts, this is, I'm not a parent, but I have lots of children.
Yes.
And it starts with your relationship with Krishna and seeing Krishna has provided this opportunity for you or for me to be an assist to this soul to connect with Krishna. I have some, you know, not parent authority position, but some authority position where I can, you know, say things and demand things or instruct things or, you know, I have that, according to Bhagavad Gita, I have that authority. But, I'm not interested so much in using that authority. I'm interested, when it's needed, but what I'm interested in is the relationship of this bringing this soul closer to Krishna in an effective and sustainable way. And with parenting, that's the package for a whole bunch of years. Like every day, so many hours every day. That's the opportunity of service for that spirit soul. And then there's different stages and state, you know, and then comes lovely teenage, and that, you know, it's an interesting period too. But there's other needs during the earlier stages, and so the soul getting closer to Krishna. Dealing with the holistic picture of the personality and the stage and the needs and the etc. And the alignment is all of that to come closer to Krishna. Now you don't have to have a hammer and hammer it, but just that's the mood. And if that's the mood of the parent, there's a sense of shelter from towards the parent from the child. And if it's, you know, a controlling mood, it's going to be a different relationship. There may be obedience, but there won't necessarily be love. And so the obedience isn't sustainable. When the child is away from the parent, okay, let me check it out. Lots of others doing other stuff. Maybe, yeah, I'm curious what's going on over there. And then the fruit of parenting doesn't sustain as much as it could. So, it's a service. Because, you know, it's just, how do you see it as a service? Because it's a service. And Krishna has given you. There's some married couples that don't have children. That's not a service that Krishna has given them. Krishna has given you that service. You've been entrusted with a soul or some souls that your function is to help them come in this lifetime, get closer to Krishna, connect with Krishna. And then there's the whole holistic package of how that is done. Customized for each member of the family. And if that's the mood, then the children will do the same. Towards the other family members, and then outside the family, and then in the community, and so on.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll end there. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Yeah.